Our subject tonight is immensely interesting. It's the subject of the subconscious, and the subconscious leads into the superconscious and to all sorts of other things, so I think we'll have a very enjoyable evening. Is my volume high enough for you all to hear me comfortably? Because I can hear the hum of the fans, but all right. Graham mentioned that what I'm offering to you is what I myself have learned from teachers far more qualified to speak than I. Paramhansa Yogananda was one of the first, the first Indian master to have a life mission to live and teach in the West. His book, Autobiography of a Yogi, is really one of the definitive books of the movement that we're all part of just by merely by sitting in this store. I was fortunate enough to meet one of Yogananda's direct disciples, Swami Kriyananda, an American man with an Indian name now, who in 1948 was 22 years old, read Autobiography of a Yogi, which at that point had been published for 2 years. Yogananda died in 1952, so he was still living in Los Angeles when Kriyananda read that book in New York City. Was so completely magnetized by that book that he left everything behind, crossed the country on a Greyhound bus, was able to come to Yogananda on September 12, 1948. His first words to Yogananda were, "I want to be your disciple." And within that hour, he was initiated as a disciple and as a monk. And all these years later, because Kriyananda is still living, he's 85 now, 60 plus years, he simply lived to serve his guru. I was 5 years old in 1952 when Yogananda died and did not have the good karma to encounter him anywhere. But I did have the good karma in 1969, when I was actually 22, to meet Swami Kriyananda right here in this area. He was lecturing at Stanford University. I was already dedicated to the idea of changing my consciousness, but I was absolutely at loose ends as to figure out how to do that. I could not get from these marvelous books I was reading, which I was buying at East West Bookstore, actually, which was in Menlo Park at that time. It was my little church. I would go there and pick up book after book and read book after book, but I couldn't figure out what actually to do about it. And I saw personified in Swami Kriyananda someone who had made these extremely elevated teachings practical. And I literally, in the first minute that I met him, I made a commitment that is still the guiding force in my life. I've written a book about Kriyananda, which is available in the front of the store if you happen to be interested. And what I have appreciated from that moment to this moment is exactly what Graham was kind enough to say about me, which is that he made everything so clear. And he really demystified a lot of extremely complicated ideas. He didn't necessarily offer any shortcuts. You know, there are no, unfortunately, and I have to say this right from the start in answer to your very sincere questions, there are no shortcuts. It's not like I'm going to be able to give you the 5-minute solution to everything that ails you. You know, working out all your past lives between now and the time we leave. You know, I can't do it because I don't think it works. You can certainly get a boost every now and then, and I hope tonight will be at least helpful to you. But what we really have to understand is, well, it took us a really long time to get into this mess. It took us a long time to get as confused and misguided as we are in certain ways. And so when you take a long journey in one direction, it's a long journey back. I've traveled to India a number of times. The plane flight is about 100,000 hours long, as far as I can tell. And the return flight is even longer. And you go there, and the only way to get home is the way you got there. And so when we start talking about our consciousness, specifically the entry point of our discussion is our subconscious, but we're not just going to stay there because subconscious doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's part of the rest of our awareness. It's a very complex subject, and what I'm going to try to lay out for us tonight is the way Paramhansa Yogananda and Swami Kriyananda have explained it, how it fits into our life and what we need to do about it. It's an extremely important aspect of spiritual life, as I will explain, not because it's the source of our spirituality, but, as my friend here commented, it's one heck of an obstacle. if it's not really working for us. That's the bad news. The good news is it really is, even though it feels mysterious, it actually has no power of its own. It has accumulated strength, but it doesn't have the capacity to initiate. And that's how, and that will lead me into now a real discussion of what we're talking about. For those of you who have never attended any program I've given, apparently I have an endless supply of words. At least I have never yet hit the end of them. So I will start talking, and I'll have certain ideas in my mind that I'll need to finish. And usually I'll make a whole presentation before I'll ask for questions. And so we'll probably go for about 45 minutes or maybe a little longer, but then I'll offer you the opportunity to ask questions at the end. That's usually my method. So, but if a question arises in your mind, hold it for two reasons. One, you don't want to forget it. And two, as you see, I have no notes in my hands. And I started out just by asking you why you were here, because the way Swami Kriyananda has trained us to share these teachings is exactly in this method. There are, you know, 100 at least different ways we could talk about this subject tonight. But even though I'm the only one making noise, this is actually much more of a conversation than you may appreciate, because it's the questions that you have in your minds, even not fully articulated, but the whatever it is you came here to learn is what inspires me to speak. So more than most audiences realize, you're really responsible for the quality of what happens. So if we work together to understand, I think we can have an interesting night. All right? Those are the ground rules, and then we can start. We can't talk about the subconscious alone without really describing what are, in fact, the three levels of consciousness that characterize being a human being. And they're very simple words. And I actually, tonight, I have a handout, which is something I almost never have, so don't let me forget to give it to you. There's the superconscious, there's the conscious, and then there is the subconscious. Now, we may think of these as distinct little boxes, you know, that the subconscious just sort of lives in a little closed container like those little Tupperware things that you put your salads in, you know, and you close it up and that's that, and then there's the conscious mind, and then there's the superconscious, but it's not at all like that. What we are describing is a spectrum of awareness from less to more. And the premise even of the subconscious existing, and especially the premise of there being these three levels of consciousness, is that we are an ever-changing reality. That there is no fixed thing that I can identify as myself or that you can identify as yourself. I mean, just think about it for half a second and you'll realize that that's true. You know, who you were this morning is completely different than who you are this afternoon, if for no other reason than that much time has passed, you're that much closer to the end of your life, you're that much farther away from the beginning of it. You've had thousands and thousands of impressions and thoughts, reactions, responses. Maybe it's been a totally dull day for you. Maybe it's been a very dramatic day. You have no idea. But in every way, you have been in a certain state of consciousness that has been constantly shifting according to what's been coming in, and more even than what's been coming in, the reactions and responses that you have had to whatever your experiences have been. Swami Kriyananda made a very interesting statement once. He said, I don't recommend, he said, that you judge yourself spiritually, that you try to evaluate, you know, whether you've progressed, whether you haven't. He said, but if you are going to think at all in terms of who am I spiritually, he said, you cannot judge yourself by any accomplishment. Because by its very nature, by the time you can claim something, even in the act of claiming it, you see, it's already behind you. By the time it's manifested, oh, I wrote this great book, oh, I won the Nobel Peace Prize, I was elected President of the United States, whatever it might be, by the time it's manifested into material form, time has passed and you're already moving beyond it. So he said, if you're going to evaluate and think about yourself at all, You should think about yourself in terms of the direction you're going and what you aspire to achieve, because your aspirations, more than your accomplishments, really define who you are. Because you see, we're always in motion. There's time, space, energy, we're always in motion. And even that which we call ourselves, you know, the body ages, time passes, the who we were when we were little children, the bodies are, of course, completely different. Our outlook on life is completely different. Our relationships were different. And yet there is an identifiable sense of self that can remember being that child. You can look in a picture of yourself and see who you used to be. Recently, I'm part of the Ananda community, which is residential spiritual communities. In 1971, I moved to the Ananda community in Nevada City, California, which was the first founding community, at that time the only one. I lived there for 16 years. In 1987, my husband and I moved here. We've lived here since then. We have a residential community here. So I have a very unusual for an American. I've had the same friends for like 40 years. I've seen their children grow up and all of those things. And it's so interesting because it's a very far-flung family now. It's a global family. I was just looking at, God bless Facebook, I was just looking at Facebook, you know, pictures of young adults that I know now when they were in junior high. They had one generation of our children had a reunion, and so they posted pictures. And there were pictures of father, daughter, about six daughters and fathers that I know, taken maybe 20 years ago. And it was just so interesting because everybody pretty much is recognizably who they are, but they're not the people in those pictures anymore because consciousness has shifted. And people get better or worse as time passes, depending entirely on what they've been doing internally during all that time. As a woman of a certain age, which I have betrayed, if you want to do the math, you know what age that is, and it doesn't matter to me that you know. In this quadrant of my life, I've always thought of my life in 20-year segments, and I age myself out to the end of those 20-year segments because that's where I'm going, and that gives me a sense of what this one is about. So when I crossed 60, I started thinking that I was 80. And I started looking around at women of that age to just sort of see what the future held for me. Since that time, I've actually taken a vow of sannyas, which is a renunciate's vow, which is why if you see me, I'm always dressed in essentially this blue costume, which changed the parameters of what was available to me considerably. But when I first turned 60, I didn't know this was an option, and I started looking around at older women and sort of made up how I was going to last. People have to look at me. If I lived in a solitary way, I wouldn't care at all. But people have to look at me, and just out of consideration, I have to think about it at least a little bit. Otherwise, being an eyesore is not an asset when you're trying to get people to listen to you. But I saw something very interesting. I had an aunt who died a year ago. She was 89 when she died. She had been an avid bird watcher. She was very uninterested in feminine wiles. She had a dear husband who loved her just the way she was. She never wore any makeup. She never did anything with her hair but just pulled it back into a little bun. Because she was an avid bird watcher, she was outside a lot, so her face weathered, you know, because her generation, they didn't always sunscreen up, you know. But I observed that by any conventional measure of feminine beauty, she was a washout. It was over for her. I mean, 89 is not young, okay? But she had, all through her life, these really impressive little blue eyes, very, very bright, very intelligent, very interested in life. And over the years, as I watched her, I realized that she gradually became nothing but her eyes. And it's actually really interesting when you look. I mean, it's more important, it's more in the consciousness of females because of the terrible trick that God plays on us, you know, and the image of feminine beauty and all of those different things. But of course, it's just as true for men. The older we become, the more our appearance is entirely defined by our eyes, because that is the part of us that is still there. You know, the body's just kind of, I must say, disintegrating around us. And when I actually really cognized that really deeply, it was such a joyful and liberating idea, because the only part of us that we actually have any real control over is our eyes, because our eyes tell the world who we actually are. And who we actually are is our consciousness. And whereas we may have the feeling that we don't have mastery over our consciousness, at least potentially we do. And what keeps us from doing it to a large extent is subconscious influence, but that's what we're going to talk about tonight, about how it all works and how to work with it. I have a young friend who has, as often young men do, who has really hasn't really launched himself onto the world yet. He has had and still has ambitions, and those ambitions are laudable ambitions. They're not unworthy ambitions, but he has a desire, many desires, to do things in the world, and at the same time has had somewhat of an interest in the spiritual path that I've followed, but has been hesitant to embrace it too deeply for fear that it would take away from him his opportunity to fulfill his worldly ambitions. And, you know, there's some truth in it. I was amused. There's a very good website up. It has nothing to do with me or Ananda. It's called Ask a Monk. It's put up by, maybe some of you know about it. I just discovered it. It's put up by a Westerner. I don't know what Western country he's from, America or Canada. And he's an American Buddhist, nice man. I really like his vibration. And I especially liked his personality in this respect. He gives videos answering questions about Buddhism, short YouTube videos. And there were a lot of comments underneath, and one man wrote, "I'm very attracted to being a Buddhist monk, except I really can't deal with this giving up money and sex." And the monk writes back, "If you're not interested in giving up money and sex, what part of being a monk attracts you?" You know, it's like, let's face it, what could you be thinking? Well, so my young friend, you know, is a little attracted, but is afraid he's going to lose things he wants. So I just started quizzing him in this respect, and he was already very developed in many different areas. I said, in this particular area of your life, what is the limiting factor? And we discussed it for a while, and finally, this is where I was leading, and this is where he came to. What always holds us back is ourself, isn't it? You know, our lack of self-mastery. And tremendous talents never get developed or expressed because in one way or another, we're not disciplined enough, we're not focused enough, we're not confident enough, we're not energetic enough, we allow others to deter us from our objective, you know, any number of things. In other words, the more we have control and can direct by our will our energy, our consciousness, our talents, our time, then the more we can do what we set out to do in life. Isn't it just, it's so odd how often we start out in one direction and end up in another. I actually, for a long time when I would counsel with people, I would get very confused by what they would say to me and then how they would manifest. And I realized, and I'm going to explain it a little bit tonight, the energy in the chakras is the place where the subconscious is stored. And when we're trying to move through life, we're trying to draw energy up through the chakras and direct it with higher willpower and higher awareness. But within the chakras, there are all these what are called vrittis, which are whirlpools, which are pre-commitments of energy. We have to be angry at this person. We have to worry about this person. We have to feel inadequate in this way. We have to feel resentful of what happened 300 years ago here. We have all these different things. So when the energy starts flowing in a straight line and we think it's going in a straight line, it actually goes way sideways. And by the time it comes out, it's been drawn off into something that we may not even know is there. And I've certainly seen it in my own life too. I think I'm going in a straight line, but at the end of the day, I ended up here. And I don't even always know exactly when I made that decision. Recently, the most amazing thing happened to me. I set out to say something that was very positive toward one person, and instead I just said something that was so strange and had such terrible repercussions in my life. And I there was no point at which I decided to say it. And I didn't even really mean it. But it was just like forces play on us all the time. These are the forces of the chakras, which is the repository, is the means by which the subconscious mind communicates with us. Okay? So when I'm talking about these three levels of consciousness as a spectrum, what we're talking about is ourselves from our most contracted reality to our most expanded, you know? And our most contracted reality is the part of us that is most deeply identified with the particular incarnation we're in, with the fact of incarnating in a physical body at all, with what happens to that body, what has happened to bodies that we've had in previous lifetimes. In other words, ourselves identified with material form. Now, most of the time we just walk around and we're inside a body and we have we make the natural assumption, which seems almost commonsensical but isn't, that this is who I am. But I was speaking a little while ago about how much the body changes and how much our awareness can change even while we're in one body. And the body, if we're observant, we really figure out is just the vehicle through which we relate to this world, but it is not ourselves. You know, sometimes the body becomes sick, sometimes the body gains weight, sometimes the body ages, always the body ages. You know, different things happen to us, and it doesn't necessarily define us. It sort of happens around us. And what's also associated with this body is this belief that we are physical, material entities subject to the conditions of the physical world and subject to all the fears and sufferings that are inherent in having a physical body. But in fact, with a little bit of meditation, a little bit of reflection, a little bit of intuitive experience, or even just a little bit of serious thinking about it, we realize that there's a continuing reality in us that is independent of that body. And anyone who has had a death and return experience or has read and believed any of the accounts of people who have died clinically and then returned to their bodies, they tell you without any doubt at all, you step out of this body and you find out that that's who I am. I am the consciousness, the individual consciousness that is still me, that still, it's not like you merge into the infinite, but you step out of this body, you are still deeply identified as this individual, but that individual exists completely independently of the body. And such a person will die, travel around in the astral worlds, meet angels, meet guides, meet Jesus Christ, do all sorts of things, watch all the people, watch his body be carried away. When Danyon Brinkley, who had one of the most dramatic experiences some decades ago, saved by the light, and he was struck by lightning, and he was dead on the ground, and his wife called the paramedics, and they all came in and they were working on him, and he was watching over the shoulder of the paramedic, them trying to resuscitate his own body. He's a very humorous man. He said his first thought was, "I always thought I was better looking than that." I suspect he was not at his best. And his true self, which was his eyes, were not functioning in that body right then because the animating force was outside that body. And they were just carrying this dead body around for a while until after he had the most remarkable experiences, he went back and got into it again. But you know, you only have to have that happen once for you to think really differently about this body. And he became so magnificently courageous about everything. Because who cares? He would say, what are you going to do? Kill me? Ha, 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 like that, you know? It just meant nothing to him. And now, you know, movies, television, it's all based on that true understanding. So we're just going to go forward as if that is true, because it is true. The most contracted point of our awareness is when we are identified, trapped, influenced, unable to transcend the commitment and the feeling. There's a few chairs in the back if you need one. The commitment and the feeling that my life is defined by this physical body. Then I'll go to the superconscious, which is the opposite end of that, which is when is the part of us that knows that we are purely vibrations of spirit. We are purely energy. We are purely consciousness. And that our individual consciousness is actually linked to the infinite. The poetic way it's often spoken of is we are just bubbles in the great ocean of spirit. We are bubbles. We are individual bubbles. And there is an eternal reality to our individuality. That's what the masters tell us. Yogananda says every atom is dowered with individuality. So there is a unique quality to every individual, but we are unique as bubbles in the sea. So you can think of that image and see all the bubbles in the sea and see that all of them are just manifestations of the same force, but they are individual manifestations. The word for our individuality, which is a great Sanskrit word, is the word jiva. Often we use the word soul instead, but soul is a slightly confusing word because soul is the infinite and the individual. So if we use the word jiva, that means the individual soul, which is our particular little bubble of consciousness. And that is who we really are, and that individual jiva steps in and out of many different bodies on the long educational journey of discovering what is really going on in this world and who we really are. What is real? What causes us suffering? And where does our happiness really come from? And the answer to those questions is the definition of how contracted or expanded we are. When we're very contracted, when we live in this body, we live in great fear that of anything that might happen to it. That's why these death and return experiences are so interesting. You know, Daniel Brinkley's body died, and he realized that nothing had happened to him. His body had died, it was true, but nothing had happened to him. And even still, from that perspective, even though he could see that his wife was quite distressed and there was all this going on, he could still see that beyond that, everything was unfolding exactly as it was supposed to unfold. You know, even when we have difficult experiences in our life or challenges to meet, when we have some sense that there's a reason for this happening and it's going somewhere, if you're training for a great athletic event and you think about every minute how you spend your time and work very hard at that, you still don't consider that to be a bad thing that's happening, because as challenging as it might be, you're going somewhere. In other words, it has meaning. There's a marvelous book by a man named Viktor Frankl called The Search for Meaning. Viktor Frankl was a Jewish psychiatrist who, at the age of like 24, was arrested by the Nazis in Europe. His wife and his mother both died almost immediately, and he survived the whole experience. He didn't know that his wife and mother-in-law had died, but he was the only one who survived. Without going into his whole story, which is marvelous, he later became a psychiatrist. He later developed a psychiatric method that was based on meaning, on the search for meaning. And his principle was that things are only difficult if we think that they have no meaning. Once that we understand they have meaning, he said, then the whole perspective shifts. And I breathe in because sometimes I cry when I tell this story, so I'll try to tell this story. The example from the book that was so powerful was an elderly man had had a beloved wife, and they'd been married for more than 50 years, and then she died. And he was just inconsolable. And he just fell into this depression that he couldn't shake, and finally his friends persuaded him to come and see Dr. Frankl. So he's sitting there with Dr. Frankl, and they're talking about what happened, and he says, you know, did you love your wife very much? And he talks about how much he loved her, and did she love you? She was completely devoted to me. Did you spend a great deal of time together? We were always together. We did everything together. Many people get tired of one another. We never tired of each other's company. Naturally, the man was anxious to just talk about the woman he loved. And so then Dr. Frankl said, after all this had been well established, he said, if you had died first and left her behind, how do you think she would have felt? Oh, he said, she would have been so sad. And then Dr. Frankl looked at the man and he said, well, you spared her that suffering, didn't you? And the man just stood up, shook the doctor's hand, and walked out. You see, it's all in how you look at it, isn't it? Nothing changed, just the perspective on it. Now, our great march as a jiva through these many incarnations is us relearning who and what we really are. Superconscious is where we connect to the infinite. Subconscious is where we separate ourselves from the infinite for any number of reasons. Okay? Now, the characteristics of each of these levels of consciousness are quite different, and since our talk is about the subconscious, naturally we'll start there. The thing we have to understand about the subconscious, and this is a very important aspect of it is not creative. The subconscious does not create anything. The subconscious is the storehouse. It's the repository. And I'd mentioned earlier the chakras. In this length of time, I can't talk about everything. But in as much as we're talking about reincarnation, as well as what happens in one life, the way the subconscious information is carried from lifetime to lifetime is that the impressions are recorded in the chakras. The chakras are a non-physical reality. They are part of the anatomy of the astral body, so to speak. And the astral body is the blueprint from which the physical body is created each time. The chakras are an ever-mutating blueprint because they are nothing but a pattern of energy, and they are the way that the subconscious, the link, so to speak. And that pattern of energy is created by every bit of action, thought, feeling that we do. Each time we do something, that energy is recorded somewhere in the chakras according to this spectrum of contracted versus expanded. This is a simplified explanation, but basically the chakras are a spectrum from the most contracted to the most advanced, exactly like this. Complete identification with matter is the reality, complete identification with spirit and every possible thing in between. And whenever we have a thought, feeling, action, response to anything, we are, you know, instinctively answering the question, what is real? You know, what is making me happy? What is making me sad? Every response you have is one of those. Because we think we are bodies, because we think we are individuals, because we think we are bound by what happens to this individual, we have all these ideas about what makes us happy, what makes us sad, and what's real. And every time we have one of those responses, it's recorded as energy in the chakras. And when we are in the astral world, we live more consciously from the chakras themselves. When we come into a physical body, the chakras are more hidden. And the influence of everything that's stored there influences us mostly through the subconscious, because it's past. What's recorded in the chakras is in the past. And the subconscious just saves up information. Now, sometimes it puts that information together in ways that haven't occurred to us, but all of the information in the subconscious has been put there by you. Now, you asked me that question about other people trying to get into our awareness. Let me just think how that would work for just a minute. Did somebody actually plant energy? I suppose there would be a way of invading your consciousness, but I'm going to hold that thought for just a minute, because that's a whole other subject. So let me just hold this one for a minute. Let's just say, everything in our subconscious mind is put there by us. It is exactly like the memory in your computer. It's exactly like the way your computer has been programmed. I use my computer all day long. I understand only a tiny bit about it. I have a new one that works really well, but some of the other computers I have hated me. And they would do things to me and to my work, you know? I know Graham, who was here just a moment ago, who lives next door to me in the Ananda community, is my young, technical-minded friend. I can literally throw an apple into his front living room. He lives so close. And so he hears me wail, or he gets an email, or he gets a phone call, and he comes over and he unravels it. But I know it hates me. He says it doesn't. He says that everything it does has an explanation, but I don't feel that way about it. Right? Because it really does just respond to input. And it just feeds you back in the most impersonal way whatever you gave it. The analogy is too obvious. We think the subconscious is doing something to us. We think that it's completely unreasonable. We think that something else is in there running it and that it hates us. It doesn't. It is merely feeding back to us whatever we have over a long period of time told it to do. You know, and there's an expression in the computer world which is called garbage in, garbage out. Everyone knows that one, right? That means that if you program it badly, it works funky. If you program your subconscious mind badly, it works really, really funky. And if you find yourself, as you know, this lady here asked, and I certainly have been in my own life, finding out that your subconscious mind is feeding you garbage all the time, that's a very helpless feeling. Because our conscious mind has another idea. And I'll talk about the conscious in just a moment. But the subconscious mind is the momentum that we're working with. And so it's just going to keep us going in a certain direction. It's the foot on the accelerator that is determining where the car is. It's where, whatever lane we're presently driving in and all the forces that got us there. And if you're in the left lane and you're going 85, you know, you've got a lot of momentum heading that way. But you got there by getting in your car, putting gas into it, checking the map, finding the freeway, getting on, you know, putting your foot onto the accelerator, driving the car, choosing the lane. You may find yourself there, but you can trace it back. You got there. But even though it seemed like a good idea at the time, you may have now decided that you're not on the road you want to be on at all. You've just seen all your exits shooting by, and you don't even like the passengers in the car with you. But at some point, you put all that garbage in there, and now it's feeding back to you. Now, this is the good news. This is really, really good news, because it means that all you have to do with the subconscious mind is re-educate it. All you have to do is start feeding it from this second forward who you want to be tomorrow. And it's completely stupid. It'll just take the good as easily as it'll take the bad. It doesn't have a judgmental filter on it, except the ones that you've set in place, but they can be dismantled. You may have to invite Graham over, but they can be dismantled. You know, they can be taken down. Well, you've invited me over by coming in here. You know, you're asking me the questions. So the first thing we have to become is very, very optimistic. And the difficulty of redoing the subconscious mind is exactly the same as getting out of the left lane when you're going 85 miles an hour. It's exactly as hard to shift it as there is momentum going in the direction that you've gone. But one of the other factors that we have to really keep in mind here is that there's nothing unfair about this. Nobody's really out to get you. And when we really start talking about the chakras, which of course we're not going to talk about, but if we really started talking about the chakras, what the chakras describe is the energetic relationship between all the different past experiences. And one of the things, of course, that makes the subconscious mind confusing to work with is because it really is imprinted from the chakras, and the chakras carry karma from lifetime to lifetime, we don't really know what's in there. And it's not necessarily easy to find out in detail what's in there. But we can find out a lot what's in there by looking at our lives. You know, what is going on? What is working? What isn't working? Who do I appear to be? What's coming out of my eyes? What's coming out of your eyes is going to tell you a lot of what's inside of you. And if you like what's coming out of your eyes, then keep on doing what you're doing. And if you're not having as much fun as you would like to have, then one of the ways to begin to work with is you begin to reprogram the subconscious. I know that sounds very complicated, but it isn't. Your subconscious is created minute by minute by how you answer the questions, what is real, where does my suffering come from, and what causes me happiness. And then the commitment of energy that you put behind the answers to those questions. You see? And so people who are consistently complaining, the husband of my aunt, who also died last year, and he was 95, he was a bit of a curmudgeon. He was a good man, a very good man, very bright, you know, had very high values, but he was a bit of a complainer. And the older he got, and his mind began to go a little bit toward the end of his life, and he used to like to repeat to me the things that had happened in his life that made him so angry. And usually there were stories of other people's stupidity, which had just been a kind of inclination of his. And being a very smart guy, a lot of people were less bright than he was, and he was completely conscious of that fact, let's just put it that way. And so when I was trying to just, you know, be a little cheerful for him. He liked me sort of irrationally. He didn't really know why he liked me. He thought everything that I'm into was completely stupid, and he often told me that. But despite that, he never saw cause and effect. He thought everything I was doing was a complete delusion, but somehow in the midst of it, I came out a good person. He probably thought it was genetic. Then he could take credit for it, but that's another story. But he was telling me for about the 10th time some repetitive story about this thing that other people had done. And I let him tell it because there was no stopping him. And then later I said something to him like, "Do you enjoy just thinking about all the things that make you angry?" And he said, "Yes." And I thought, oh, okay, you know, there's nothing to do here. He'd filled his subconscious mind with righteous indignation. And so now that he had even less control, conscious control of it, it just kept pouring out righteous indignation. But he liked that. That was who he had been his whole life. And he had chosen to be that way. For me, it seemed like an unfortunate choice, and I was going to try to help him, but he was not interested. And it made me laugh. I mean, I had to sort of walk away. I was laughing so much at it. Just like, okay, you know, if this is the momentum you want to live with and you haven't noticed that it's not working for you, good for you. Let's just go forward. But every single time we have a thought, we think that we have these thoughts and they just go away. They don't. Nothing ever goes away. Energy is not lost. And because we live in these physical bodies and because we have an ego, and ego in this sense means simply the infinite soul, the jiva, identified with the physical body. And that's this contracted part. As long as we have an ego, and we have egos for a really long time, as long as we're identified with this physical body, every time we do anything, every time we launch any little, you know, fragment of energy, because we believe that we did it, it stays with us. And only when we have transcended the soul's identity with the physical body do we stop identifying with what we do, and we stop making karma for ourselves, is really what the word is for it. Because every time we do something, it registers in the chakras, and then chakras makes the impression, which is the subconscious mind. But as I started to say a minute ago, all we have to do is realize that we are in command of that system. Now, once you start in a certain direction, when you're going 85 miles an hour, it takes a little while to move that car over. But the first step is just the thought, I really don't like the direction I'm going. Now, this is not going to change in a minute. It might not even change this whole incarnation. But next incarnation, you might as well have started now. There's a certain point when you begin to realize that nothing is going to rescue me. We spend a great deal of our lives, it's a very interesting concept, waiting to be rescued. I had a friend of mine who had a great deal of difficulty with her weight. She was extremely skilled with money, extremely skilled. She used to give classes on money. She just has, you know, really has a talent for money. Weight, she didn't have such a talent for. And she would give these classes on money, standing up there clearly with the problem with weight, because, as she said, you can do many worse things in life and nobody knows, but if you have a problem with weight, everybody knows. So at some point in her seminar, she would have to sort of say what she knew people were thinking. Why don't you just use some of these principles on your weight? And she would say, I know these principles should work on weight. I can work them for money. I can't work them on my body. She says, I don't know why, but that was a fact. But then she told me this marvelous story. She just spent years and years trying to figure out all these things about weight and how to deal with it and so on. And I'm not casting aspersions on anyone who has that difficulty. I have a tremendous respect for how these things grab us. But she said she finally had a super conscious dream in which a spiritual guide came to her and said, if you want to weigh less, eat less. And she just in the dream sort of said, oh. And she just really had to realize she had been spending years just waiting to be rescued. You know, that a certain momentum had been set in place. Her subconscious mind was always telling her that she would starve to death or be utterly deprived emotionally or that she would crack apart, you know, just all the different things that get us into trouble in the first place. And she was just hoping to be rescued from that force. And finally, just that dream penetrated her consciousness and she realized there is no rescue. I've walked a great distance away from balance in this particular area of my life, and the only way to get back is the way I came, with just this long, slow, trudging walk. But the good news about it is we got over here because we walked here. And the worst of it is we always thought it was a good idea at the time. And we're just so dumb. And even now, we still think it's a good idea, you know, to wait to be rescued. I used to, I'm part of, as I mentioned, the Ananda community, and we moved here from Ananda Village now 25 years ago, but when we first came here, Ananda has a number of communities around the world, different jobs, different assignments. I had no idea this would be essentially what's turned out to be a lifelong assignment. I thought we'd be here a few years, then we'd go off and start another community and another. I've been part of founding two. I thought I might be founding a lot more, but it hasn't turned out that way. It's fine. But for many, many years, in the back of my mind was the thought that Swami Kriyananda would call us one day and suggest that we move somewhere else. And on a couple of occasions, we almost moved back east. You know, a few things happened. Three times I thought we were going to leave. And after the third time, Swami just said to us, he said, I really just don't see where else, you know, you're doing good work there, and I don't see any other place really even in the whole world to send you. So I just think you should settle in. And it was amazing to me when I really finally thought that I'm never going to move away from where I'm living right now, to what a degree subconsciously I had been waiting to be rescued. I've been waiting to be rescued, not in a massive sense, but, you know, from really learning, opening my heart to that unpleasant person, from really having patience with this person over here, from really figuring out what could grow in that dead corner of the garden, from really cleaning out that closet. I mean, just so many different things. Because that's what the subconscious mind does. The nature of the subconscious is it wants results without effort. The subconscious mind likes low energy. It likes to sink back to whatever used to be. By its very nature, it just wants the status quo to continue. And for the status quo to continue is the lowest energy alternative that there is. The subconscious mind is always persuading you, why bother? Why make changes? Just let it be. Things will work out. But it's not telling you from a transcendent point of view. It's telling you because that'll be less difficult. You know, just eat the ice cream. Just turn on the television. Just don't bother to practice your piano. You know, don't take that night class. You know, don't really open your heart to that person. Just stay right where you are. Because the subconscious mind is not creative. It just wants to perpetuate. Now, the superconscious, and I won't go into it as much in much detail, but the superconscious is the source of expansive change. This is the source of creative thought, creative reality. This is the highest form of creativity. The subconscious can reorganize what it already knows. The superconscious can come up with actual new inspirations. And so the superconscious is always trying to tell us, be more than you've ever been before. Come into the new reality of who you actually are and what you could actually be. Open your heart to life. Have courage. You know, think in new ways. You have talents. Develop them. Put out energy. The more energy you put out, the more dynamic you'll feel. The more dynamic you feel, the happier you'll be. Give to others. Everything that expands us. You can make your own long list of all the ways that you know you're being pulled forward. And then all the ways your subconscious mind just says, oh, just sink back. It's really a lot of trouble, isn't it? And after all, you're getting old. I had a conversation with my father, too. I took my father through to the end of his life, my uncle a little bit, my father a lot. At one point, I was urging my father to some new understanding. And again, this is like, you know, we project upon others our own reality. I was urging him to some new understanding. And finally, in just exasperation, I'm not proud of this, but I did this. In exasperation, I said, don't you want to just keep growing? He looked at me with horror in his eyes. He said, no, just like that, no. It's like, I just want to sort of like get through to the end now. My mother was ill. He was hurt by that. He just, expansiveness did not look attractive to him. Again, that was like, oh, what am I doing? And I just backed way off and sort of rethought my, and he did. He just wanted to be made comfortable. And very shortly after that, he went on a little mental vacation. He just sort of let his consciousness slip a little bit, and he went into a very, very pleasant, mild dementia. You know, not big, just mild, enough so that he forgot what he was worried about. He did just what he wanted. He just sort of sat back in his subconscious. Now, my father was a very sweet man, and when he forgot what he was worried about, he got really, really sweet. Unlike my uncle, who was an angry man, my father was a very sweet man, and his subconscious mind just was very, very sweet when he forgot what he was worried about. And he just sank back. He just had it. He took a 2-year vacation and then he died, right? But the superconscious is what's always calling us. We have a school at Ananda for kindergarten through eighth grade, pre-K through eighth grade. And there was a kindergarten child in that class, and she was a doozy of a girl. She was really something. She has grown up to be a very impressive woman. And when she came in as a kindergartner, she was a powerhouse. She had a little sort of jelly bean shaped body and really forceful. And one day she was being horrible. And the teacher just, you know, took her aside and said, you know, what is going on with you? Well, she said, every day I come to school and there's a dark angel on one side and there's a light angel on the other. And I decided today to listen to the dark angel. And that was just pretty much what she was doing. Well, the dark angel, in a real sense, is our subconscious. I don't mean that our subconscious is inherently dark, but the subconscious is what just wants us to stay as we are. It looks to the past for comfort, and the superconscious is challenging us to become more. But the subconscious is just feeding us what we've fed it. So the subconscious can be totally changed, but from the superconscious. If we feed the subconscious with our superconscious commitment, that it's so dumb, it just begins to want you to become superconscious. If your responses to life are expansive, then what gets stored up as the pattern of the so-called past is just exactly where you're trying to go in the future. Of course, the balance has to be shifted. And the conscious mind, just to say it in here, is not really a place in itself. It's the battleground between the two forces. And that's where we are all the time. And that's what the subconscious mind is about. We live at the conscious level when we're awake, and when we have our will engaged, and oftentimes people walk around completely subconscious. It's very common because they just don't have their will engaged and they're just living from the subconscious. And that's where you have people who just have their own take on reality, who will not believe you even when you tell them, who are just stuck in their old ways of doing things, they become psychological antiques, was Yogananda's word for them. And he said, and eventually God has no choice but to kill them off, just give them death, because they're done in their body. They're not going to grow anymore. They've just ossified at a certain point. Some people ossify as children. You know, you've seen it. They're just going to stay right where they are and nothing new is going to come in. The conscious mind is where we make the decision as to which side. Are we going to ever be reaching out to a more expanded reality? Are we just going to sink back? Most people, as they age, become more and more subconscious. They live more and more on what used to be. I watch that tendency in myself. You know, I look at young people. I'm old enough to have the concept of young people who are full functioning adults. You know, and you still think of them as young people. You have to be very careful about that. And I have to say to myself, don't become old. I can hear it in my voice. I can hear it in my mind, hear it in my attitude. They're so young. What do they know? Well, I remember when I was that young and I was pretty competent, you know. But the subconscious tells you that. And people age because they go into the subconscious. But some people age by going more and more into the superconscious. The older we get, the more detached we become from all the things that happen. And the less we have to lose. The more interesting it all is, because we've been through so much by now. What difference does it make? We recognize that something always happens. Why be so nervous about it? You know, and change is inevitable, and we were crazy too, so let's just sort of see what's going to happen next. Now, the more we live under the influence of the superconscious, the more the subconscious begins to reflect our aspirations. And the only way, and this is your question, to change the superconscious is by the patient application of willpower. In fact, the only way to accomplish anything in life, I figured out once, I bought curtains once when we were in India because they cost a fraction of what they cost here, so I brought them home and I had to hang them. And for some insane reason, I decided I would do the work myself. I am like zero tool oriented. I have a little toolkit that I got from Sharper Image. It's a pretty nifty toolkit. I decided I would hang all the curtain rods and hang all the curtains. I think I did it because I learned a very serious lesson. I knew nothing about it. I had some friends help me. If you come into my house, the curtain rods are just a little askew and some of them are falling off, but it's my project. I did it. But I realized, because I was so inept at it, that it was just a question of the patient application of willpower. I put the holes in the wrong place. I had to take it down again. I had to fill it in. I had to spackle it. I had to paint it. I had to let it dry. I had to drill the holes again, just step by step. I had to carry the ladder in. I had to carry the ladder out. I had to clean off the rug where I had forgotten to wipe off the bottom of the ladder. I had to carry the ladder in. I had to carry it out. It was just the patient application of willpower. And it was a perfect project because it meant nothing to me. I had no ego involvement in it. It was not the kind of work I usually do. It wasn't corrupted by my creative insecurities. It was just the patient application of willpower, and I realized everything in life is that, especially the shifting of your subconscious. And if you take on the project, it's just a matter of day by day vigilance to what you're doing with your consciousness. What are you thinking? I had a woman friend of mine, very talented, very capable, very nice woman who was totally insecure about herself. I tried to explain to her, the only thing wrong with you is your self-concept. You actually, as far as I can see, have no other faults. It's just your self-concept. And I said, you have to understand that every time you allow yourself to indulge in the thought that you're not good enough, which was, you know, had been programmed into her from previous lifetimes because she was born that way, that you're not good enough, you have to recognize that that is a life-threatening emergency. I said, if you were out camping, she liked to camp, and the rattlesnake came in and bit you on the arm, you would not sort of contemplate the rattlesnake. You would not reflect on this rattlesnake versus others. You would not think about whether your mother really put the rattlesnake in your tent. You know? It would be, I'm glad you're laughing, a life-threatening emergency, and you would respond accordingly. Your bad thoughts about yourself or others is a life-threatening emergency because all the rattlesnake will take away from you is your body, but your bad thoughts will take away your happiness and your possibility of future happiness. Because it will program your subconscious mind to continually feed those same things back to you. This is war. The conscious level in the Bhagavad Gita, which is, you know, the great epic of India, is a battle between cousins for control of the kingdom. And on one side are the noble good cousins, and on the other side are the dark materialistic cousins. Ah, the superconscious, the subconscious. The battlefield is called the field of Kurukshetra. And the field of Kurukshetra is the conscious mind in which cousins, in other words, different aspects of the same family, fight it out for control. And the Bhagavad Gita is a discussion between Krishna, who is the divine Lord manifested, and his chief disciple, Arjuna. And Arjuna is the primary warrior for the good guys. And there's a whole lot of symbolism that's fascinating, but I won't go into it here. But Arjuna gets an attack of subconsciousness and says, why should I fight this battle? Why should I do this? You know, these are my thoughts too. These are my own people. These are my cousins. We grew up together. This is me. How can I do battle against these? And Krishna says, coward, like that. He said, you're using words that sound wise to cover the actions of a coward and a knave like that. He said, everything depends on fighting this battle. And it was a literal physical battle, but the Gita is symbolic of the fact that it's a life-threatening emergency. You got yourself into this problem. How much longer do you want to stay here? And, of course, then we come into things like affirmations and the power of positive thinking and all of the things that you do that can lift your energy. There's, you know, multitudes of ways that you can find these things, but none of them will serve you unless you use them. You know, and you have to use them all the time. Subconscious mind is especially receptive first thing in the morning and last thing at night. Because as you're going into sleep, it's beginning to take you over. As you wake up in the morning, you're still half in it. So how you wake up and how you go to sleep, that's the most efficacious time to try to affect your subconscious mind. You know, and this gentleman asked about dreams. Dreams are when the subconscious mind is no longer controlled by the conscious. Sometimes super consciousness comes to you while you're asleep. But you can tell the difference between a superconscious and a subconscious dream. It has a completely different quality to it. Just because you're asleep doesn't mean that you're completely in subconsciousness, but usually you are. Sometimes the subconscious mind will communicate with the conscious mind while you're asleep because it can't get through to you in any other way. And it will put together images and tell you things that you might need to know. Not everything that your subconscious tells you is really worth knowing, however. So the mere fact that it happens in a dream, even in a vivid, incredible, exciting, interesting dream, Yogananda says, most dreams are just there to entertain us, you know. But sometimes they're there to educate us. So you have to be very discriminating because the subconscious mind is not necessarily wise. It's exactly as wise as you are, which may be wiser than you know or not. Superconscious is something entirely different, though. Okay, I'm going to pause. Oh, let me just say this last thought. So having an affirmation and saying it just before you go to sleep or as you go to sleep is a really good idea. Having an affirmation or something very positive in front of you just as you wake up is a very good idea. I'm a disciple of a great master. I'm the student of a great teacher. I have a picture of Yogananda and a picture of Kriyananda in my sleeping space so that it's the first thing I see when I wake up in the morning. Because as soon as possible, I want to remember my divine intention. And you know, if you just wake up, your mind is wherever you were. My eyes fall on the beautiful eyes of these great souls who've guided my life. And immediately I remember, oh yes, this is what I do when I first wake up. I lift my mind to something higher and I get up to meditate. That's why it's also a good idea to meditate the last thing before you go to sleep at night, because it begins to infiltrate the superconscious awareness into the subconscious mind. And the subconscious mind is just energy fields. And energy fields are influenced by other energy fields. Specifically, greater magnetism absorbs weaker magnetism. So superconscious energy, by definition, is stronger than subconscious energy, because this is creative and original. This is merely stored information. So as you flood your subconsciousness by your actions and by deliberate practices, flood it with superconscious energy, the whirlpools that were going around in subconsciously oriented ideas, when higher vibrations come into them, not only is that negative whirlpool dissolved, but all the energy that was there moves up into a higher level. And it's just like you put a penny in the bank of every chakra. And if you do lots and lots of positive, loving things and good, uplifting things, you put lots of pennies in the bank of more uplifted chakras, then the subconscious pattern of your mind begins to vibrate on a higher and higher level, you see? Because it's not just bad that's recorded, it's everything. That's why people will say, don't worry about anything, just meditate. Because if you meditate properly, meditate enough, what happens is the magnetism of your uplifted energy gradually absorbs the magnetism of your downward pulling subconscious energy, and you just become different. You just don't even know how you did it. I was on the spiritual path, and it takes a while. I was on the spiritual path for 12 years, from the age of 24 to 36. Almost 12 years is an astrological cycle. The planet Jupiter, which represents the guru in the horoscope, I'm telling you almost all I know about astrology, takes 12 years to go around. So every 12 years, you complete a very significant cycle. If you think about life from 12, 24, 36, 48, 60, these are very important turning points. I came to Ananda just before I was 24. I met Swami a few years earlier, but I joined the ashram life when I was 24. Virtually on my birthday when I was 36, I felt this much of a change. My subconscious mind had been working against me. Not it wasn't a fierce enemy, but every time the marble of my consciousness had a place to go, my subconscious mind would encourage it to roll downhill. So all of my spiritual effort, it was bearing fruit, but I always felt like it was a hard fight. Somehow the balance on after 12 years, it's still going to look like it's going down, but it just tipped in the opposite direction. And it wasn't like I suddenly became God-realized or anything like that, but I felt suddenly like all my mental citizens were on the same side now. Whereas for the first 12 years, I was working, we were playing tug-of-war. And it was so interesting. I know sometimes I want to tell people it takes that long, and sometimes I don't. But, after 12 years, you're still standing here. It's always now. If you waste all that time, you're just going to be exactly as you are, only 12 years older. So you might as well spend that time doing something that'll make you happy to be there. It wasn't like everything became easy, but it became noticeably less difficult. That would be the only thing that I could say. And I cannot tell you, it was a total change. Just that absolute marginal tip from being an ally, from being an enemy to an ally. And it was nothing but just the patient application of willpower, because I promise you, my first 12 years on the spiritual path were not pretty. Let's just say that. That's all I can say about it. I don't want to say more because I don't want to go back there. Okay, now, do we have any questions? Yes. What is the true source of happiness? What is the true source of suffering? These are very, very important questions. And what is real? What is really going on in this world? In the end, what's left? Where am I standing? What's left? Okay, you have your.
Can you see people's auras?
I don't have any. I don't have any really interesting abilities like that. But I can feel people's energy. And I have a certain God-given intuition, I think is what I would call it. I really say God-given because in the moment that I need to know things, I often know them. And I really don't know why I know them, I just do. But I'm not psychic. I tried to work here once as a psychic and it was just laughable. It was just like it lasted one day. Yes. Yeah.
And you said one way to notice it is by looking at what's going on in your life. So what if your life's a disaster and you want to change it?
Okay.
Is that past life, current life? How do you figure it out?
Well, the material world doesn't really exist. And this is just science. This isn't religion. It's just patterns of energy. Matter is just energy. This is Einstein's contribution. We can all just sort of say that to each other. We don't actually know that, but it's a fact. And so energy just affects energy. There's no fixed point, even though it looks like a fixed point. Energy affects energy. Magnetism is what really affects it. When energy moves, it creates a magnetic force. This is, again, about all I know about science, so now I'm telling you, but I know this. You spin electricity around, you get a magnetic force. Chakra actually means wheel. And so they're called wheels because the energy is moving. It's not stationary. It's not like the extra ice cream that you ate actually goes into your chakra as ice cream. It goes in as a vibration of overindulgence. The anger that you have at someone for what they did to you is a vibration of I am dependent on other people to make me happy, or I want to control other people's behavior, which is an answer to the question, what is real? Where does my suffering come from? Oh, my suffering comes from you, so I'm going to make you different, and then I will be happy. It's a wrong answer to those questions, and it represents somewhere on this spectrum. So it's recorded in the chakra as a vibration of energy. It's energy committed around a central idea. The idea in this case may be if other people don't behave the way I want them to, then I suffer. Or it could be, I hate you because you don't do what I want you to do. But what it is, it's a central idea, and then all the thoughts that revolve around it, and it's not the specifics, but it's the vibration of those thoughts. Okay? Now, I mean, I think we've seen these three words long enough. The way the chakras work, just very simply, is the energy runs up the spine. This is the what people call the kundalini energy. The chakras are, you know, in these various places. This being the heart, just so we can locate ourselves. This is the heart, and this is the throat, and then we have the head, and we have the spiritual eye. Did I say throat? Heart, throat, that doesn't really look like it. But anyway, there we are. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then there's this one, the seventh. Okay, and also the medulla, but this is too complicated. The energy in the energy flows through the chakras, in a whirl like that. I didn't make it right, because it should come like this. Okay? And each of these, each chakra has a whole lot of these committed energies, these committed whirlpools. So if a river is trying to, you know, go through its banks, and there's a big log here, and then there's a big mud bank here, and there's a huge rock here, the river, the smooth flow of the river is constantly being deflected. So it's at certain points in the river, if there's a whole lot of deflections, it takes a really long time and it just turns into a trickle. So what happens in our chakras is all of these fixed points of answering of the questions and all of the thoughts and actions. You know, a person can spend an entire life trying to get back at the person that they're trying to get back at. Yeah? Your whole life can be defined by it. And then you can get born back into that family so you can, as Yogananda said, fight it out at close quarters, depending on how what you decided. If you hate something or someone, you can just get surrounded by it. You know, you can make lifetimes, big lifetimes. And so these become really big whirlpools. And so instead of your energy being able to flow through your life in a nice way, it gets caught up in these whirlpools. And one of the ways you can deal with whirlpools is you can let go of the idea because you've expanded your consciousness and you realize that hating people just really didn't work so well for me. You know, you read in Reader's Digest about the mother of the murdered child who ends up going to the prison and becoming the friend of the murderer because she realized that hate was not working for her. So she dissolved it by her own realization that this is not a really good way to make me happy. The other way you can dissolve these is if the river flows stronger and stronger, then the comparative, and this is metaphysics. This is not dogma. It's not superstition. This is physics on a more subtle level. If the force of this whirlpool is stronger than the flow of this energy, the water will get deflected. If the flow of this energy is stronger than the whirlpool will get absorbed. And the idea will just get absorbed with it because the force, and one of the ways you increase the force is because you begin to express yourself, speaking of the chakras, at a higher and higher, more elevated level. And then that magnetic pattern begins to change. Now, merely because everything in your life is a mess does not mean you're being punished. It means that, hey, it's time for you to work on a lot of these vrittis, is what they're called. It's time for you to work on these whirlpools. It may also mean if it's a big log over here and the river begins to flow, that as the river begins to absorb this whirlpool, the rock comes loose, it smashes into the river, it hits the big tree that's being drawn in from this side, and there's a huge mess here. But the mess is happening because the energy is increasing and now these whirlpools are shifting. That this is the metaphysical demonstration of the divine law that God will never send you a test bigger than you can handle. Because if the test, so to speak, which is the negative challenge, is stronger than your upward moving flow of energy, it'll just keep eating the energy. It won't come to the surface. It'll only come to the surface when this flow is strong enough to begin to draw it in. And whether it dissolves effortlessly and harmoniously, and you just suddenly find yourself, like I did on my 36th birthday, feeling a heck of a lot better, not sure why, or whether everything goes to pieces, it will never come to you unless it's because there's an opportunity for an expanded consciousness. And of course, when things go wrong, our subconscious mind says, hide, put out less energy, go unconscious, take drugs, drink, overeat, watch TV. And the superconscious mind is saying, oh, this is a great opportunity for you to become somebody else. And the good angel says, go for it, girl. And the other angel says, no, no, I'm weak, I can't do it. And you see, that's where simple affirmations come, like, I am made in the image of God, and I have the power of the infinite, and all obstacles can be overcome with God, with God's help. And so as you lie in bed at night scared to death about all the things that are happening, you either lie there at night scared to death, or you say, this is a life-threatening emergency. And you pull out one of your handy-dandy consciousness-changing tools, which can easily be, and one of mine for many years was, I need it less now, thank God, because it worked, I know that God's power is limitless, and as I am made in his image, I too have the strength to overcome all obstacles. Now, affirmations, it's very important that you pick one that you can actually believe. It's a grave mistake to over-affirm. Because if you over-affirm, even as you're saying it, your subconscious mind will say, oh, come on, honey, who are you kidding? I had a friend who had to quit her job because she had a lot of allergic reactions to the lab where she was working. After some weeks or months, she was going back to work. She was naturally quite scared. And so the affirmation she was trying to say is, my body is whole and perfect and nothing but a manifestation of divine light. I said, do you believe that? No, she said, just like that. Because clearly it was way beyond what she believed. She wasn't even fully healthy. She couldn't persuade herself of that. So we worked together to find when she could say better, which is, I know that God is guiding me, and with God's grace, I will face and overcome whatever happens. And that she could really do with a lot of force, because that she believed. And this little book, I'll hold it up wherever it is, Scientific Healing Affirmations by Yogananda. There's a few copies in the store, and others can be obtained. They can order them for you easily. This is just full of great phrases, great little affirmations, and a whole lot of instruction about how to use them. Also, there's another book, Affirmations and Prayers by Swami Kriyananda. These are wonderful tools. And, of course, affirmations are, it seems so simple. You think, oh, how is this going to work? But you see, this is why it works. Because if you just sit there with no tools, your little subconscious mind just has a field day with you. Just a field day. You know, I would say affirmations when I was working to write a book, and that was where all my insecurities came out, creative insecurity. I used to have it. I'm not going to affirm it anymore. But I had to fight against my subconscious anxiety all the time. You know, when I was walking, when I was exercising, when I was cooking, when I was lying in bed at night, when I would wake up in the night, and I just duked it out. And I would just say that affirmation over and over and over again, and I won. I published a very good book. You know, my subconscious mind kept telling me I couldn't, and I just wouldn't hear of it. You know why I managed to do it? Because I believe in reincarnation. And I thought one lifetime of this karma is enough. You know, I'll die trying, because otherwise, my God, I'll be born next lifetime and I'll still be doing this. Oh, Lordy. You know, I mean, this is enough already. Unlike my father, you know, I just don't want to quit. And unlike my uncle, I was not having any fun. You know, because we're not having any fun, and it's always now. But the great thing about this is one tiny bit of positive energy, if it's just a little bigger than that, will erase that. You know, because there is nothing fixed about your consciousness. You have to say that to yourself over and over again. It feels like it's fixed, but it's not. It's energy in motion. Create an alternate energy, it shifts. Yes?
What do you think about a clash of egos? Because my understanding is ego is necessary to some degree because we don't do anything. But on the other hand, like, the ego can bluster when it's really just very weak and present a false front. Mm-hmm.
For example,
yes.
Ego is really more of a friend than an enemy, because ego is just the infinite identified with the limited, okay? And there has to be a certain amount of identification, or else you wouldn't know what body to walk around. So the ego has the capacity to reflect upon itself And so then you can begin to decide to identify with a greater and greater reality. Whenever there is a clash of egos, it's because both jivas are deeply identified with the part of themselves that is limited and therefore the part that separates them. Because if you have these little, well, think of the fingers of one hand. That's a way to see it. If you live out at the tip and identify with the tip, then there's always space between you. But you see, they're actually rooted from the same source. And the more deeply you identify with the source of both of your realities, the less reason there is to clash. But what you're actually asking is, I mean, what you can do about yourself is all the things that we're talking about. What you can do about the other person is pretty much nothing, except that families, especially, are like solar systems in which the orbits of everybody and the relative poles all hold each other in certain patterns. And if key elements shift their magnetism, then the orbits around them can shift. That doesn't necessarily mean that the person will change. Because you have to have, and this is the question about influence also, you can only influence others if your magnetism is greater than their magnetism. And if you have oppressive magnetism, if you have more magnetism to suppress than the other person has to defend, you can suppress people. But that, of course, accomplishes nothing. If you actually want to expand them, you have to have more attractive magnetism for expansion than they have determination to stay contracted. When I was dealing with my father, I was trying with words to give him expansive magnetism, but his determination to stay where he was so much greater than my logical force. And I'm not St. Francis, I'm not Mother Teresa of Calcutta. I couldn't change him. So I just loved him and figured that helped a little. That helped more than anything else. And much of the time in our lives, we end up, I mean, this is why you end up seeking God, dear friends, because what makes you happy? Where does your suffering come from? What is real? We live through many of these incarnations in which the great rose of romance turns into the everyday reality of life. And the great prince turns out to have some really bad habits. The great princess turns out to have bad habits. The children turn out to be lemons. You know, whatever it might be. One of my friends went to Swamiji once with a great dilemma about their son. And Swami Kriyananda answered, just first, he said, well, sometimes you get a lemon, just like that. And after they just got over their horror, he said, but in this case, I don't think so. But he was partly just trying to get them to realize, why should your son be somebody wonderful? Like, who's to say? Where's the contract that says that that's true? And so at a certain point in our life, when we answer the questions, where does happiness come from? Where does suffering come from? What is real? We begin to want to identify with a greater and greater reality of which this is just a small manifestation, because it really doesn't serve us to live out here at the tip, because there's just too much, we're just too vulnerable out there. And the truth of the matter is that we appear to be isolated and separate, but that is just an illusion. So suffering, disappointment, we learn more from being fulfilled, because if we don't get what we want, we always think it will make us happy. So we have to get it before we're really going to get over it, which is why a teaching like self-realization does not usually attract poor people who are trying to rise into the middle class. Because when you're saying that this world will never fulfill you and they have not yet had the fulfillments of this world, they just think it's a scam, and why would they listen to you? But once you've had a certain amount of fulfillment in this incarnation or others, begins to cross your mind that it just wasn't all it cracked up to be, even if it was great. You know, even if it was wonderful. It's still like, this is not enough. There's got to be something more. But nobody can give that to you. You have to come to that yourself. Does that answer?
Yeah.
Okay. You asked the question of, can others influence your subconscious? If people have enough force, they can... I mean, there is such a thing as one jiva actually coming in to somebody else's body. Possession is real. There's people who have practiced dominance, and they can dominate your mind. But the answer to all of that is to be very dynamic and magnetic in yourself. And also to be very connected to the white angels, to the positive force. No one can really come into your reality unless there's an opening within you. That opening can be fear. That opening can be self-doubt. That opening can be passivity. But don't walk around like this, worried about it, because it doesn't happen that commonly. But these are very good arguments against drunkenness, drugs, and over-sensuality, because souls looking to influence you, even to take possession of your body, go places where individuals have lost control over their own consciousness. Drugs, drinking, and over-sensuality causes you to lose control of your own consciousness. And when you become out of control in your own body, then there's much less of a barrier to souls coming in. Many, many, many violent crimes are committed when people are on some substance or another, and often afterwards they do not remember committing the crime. The truth of the matter is sometimes they didn't commit it, but they vacated their own consciousness sufficiently that some evil entity came in and did it through their body. Very strange. Now, you know, it's 9:05, so I'll just leave you with that. So please, somebody, ask me some other question. Well, this lady here, yes.
Maybe I'm a little confused about the subconscious versus the superconscious.
Okay, great.
Recently had an experience that I thought involved the subconscious, which was that my husband had a fairly major surgery, and in preparation,
right.
We heard of a book and a process
right.
to prepare and heal from.
Right.
Going into anesthesia,
right.
like affirmations that the anesthesiologist right. would say during surgery, going into surgery, and certain, it was amazing how quickly he healed, how quickly he got out of the hospital, how quickly he, you know, how he didn't need pain medication, and all of the things that surgery did. And so I'm wondering, was that really
you drew superconscious realities and then focused on them in the subconscious, so you lifted the level of the subconscious from the habitual, I'm afraid, I'm in pain, I'm suffering, to the idea that, no, I'm not, this is not hard, this is easy. You begin to reprogram the subconscious with superconscious ideas. So you are working from both elements of it. The normal subconscious response is, oh, surgery is horrible, I'm really going to suffer, this is going to take me 8 weeks to recover. Superconsciousness says, you're one with the infinite. What is all this tension about? So you fed the subconscious when it was receptive with superconscious ideas. You rearranged the magnetism in the subconsciousness quite significantly. And as a result, the subconscious fed him all these positive things. See, the subconscious is not bad. The subconscious is simply the accumulation of whatever you have fed it. And what you have fed it is what you've been doing. Right? And so if you live a good life, your subconscious becomes very cheerful and very helpful. And when you get into trouble, it starts telling you the affirmations. It starts singing chants. It starts automatically praying for you. It's saying, you can do it, honey. If you've been telling it over and over again that you can, it just starts answering you back. Garbage in, garbage out. You know, brilliance in, brilliance out. Okay, so that's exactly what you did. It was a perfect example. Fair enough? Yeah. Okay, well, okay, I'll take one more.
You mentioned that
right.
How can you tell when it's a superconscious?
Superconscious dreams are calm. They're filled with light. They leave you with a very happy, uplifted feeling. They have a clarity and brilliance to them. They have an intuitive truth to them. They don't dissolve into Volkswagens full of muffins, you know. They're just sort of like, they don't just have wacky things happening. Although sometimes you have semi-superconscious dreams. And they have a profound and lasting effect on you. You know, so mere the fact that Jesus comes to you in a dream, I mean, people say, oh, Jesus came to me. I mean, people actually would say this. Well, Jesus came to me last night. We sat around and shared a cigarette, you know. I don't think so. You know, it's just like, it doesn't happen like that. You can have superconscious images come into your dreams, but they can still be subconscious. Because if Jesus really comes to you in a dream, believe me, you'll know it, and you probably won't be smoking. You know, it'll be real different than that. Okay, fair enough. But you can have positive subconscious dreams. You know, just as I'm saying, subconscious is not bad. Subconscious is just static and not creative. It just accumulates and feeds back. That's the only thing. So it's great, if you're positive. Swami Kriyananda made the remark once, essentially, that his subconscious is exactly the same as his conscious and superconscious. That nothing happens in his sleep. That it's, you know, his subconscious has been completely purged of anything other than what he is committed to in his life. It's just washed out, because his commitment and his practices have been so long for so many lifetimes that his subconscious is just completely integrated with his aspirations. A result to be devoutly hoped for, and to be achieved inevitably. Okay, I'm going to call a pause to this part. If any of you have questions, I'm not going anywhere until all those questions are answered. But thank you very much.